Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Simon Hahn, author of Nights When Nothing Happened, published in November by Riverhead. Simon was born in Tianjin, China, and was raised in Texas, which coincidentally is the setting of this book and part of his life as well. He's written in The Atlantic, Guernica, Electric Literature, and many other periodicals. So, The Night When Nothing Happened is a quiet book, and we'll talk about that. And in many ways, the nights portrayed are nights when nothing happened. But in the background, and after you've read the novel, in one sitting as I did, which upsets me with Simon, since I stayed up until 4 a.m. and my girlfriend was pissed off at me that I slept in the next morning, so I'm kind of irritated about that, but I digress. So what I'm trying to say is that the Chengs, Jack, Annabelle, Patty, and Lang, have a complicated, convoluted familial relationship that veers from pedestrian to tense to frantic at times, and the tragedy and heroism of Storts and love. And a lot of it happens at night. Disturbing because it tends to remind one of things that might have happened in one's own past, relationships that might have been rocky and confusing. So all in all, basically, it sneaks up on you. So hi, Simon. Thanks so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. I love that reflection.
So anyway, as we were talking about before, I own an independent bookstore, and I say this all the time, people are probably sick of it, but as many times as you hear, you can't judge a book by its cover. Every single person, without exception, who comes into my bookstore judges the book by its cover. And I really liked yours, and I was wondering whether you had a chance to vet it or even thought of it yourself.
It was the first cover that was sent to me. Everyone loved it. I loved it. I didn't even see it. I didn't see a single other cover. So, yeah, I didn't really offer any suggestions, but I thought it captured the mood and atmosphere of the book perfectly. And I just, and even though it is fairly simple, it's got these little touches that I really liked. You know.
Hey, do you have the book there? You can hold up because my cover. Yeah, there it is. So it's like you look at it and you think, oh, so, and then you think, oh, something is going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's really, you know, the gray and the black and the white really do well on my front table. So just so you know. And then the second thing people look at is the epigraphs, because first of all, I'm always excited by them because you must think about them a lot. So that means it's important to the book. And you have two. So since they're so short, would you mind reading them when we talk about them each?
Sure. So the first one is from Dracula. But a stranger in a strange land, he is no one. Men know him not, and to know not is to care not for. And the second is a section of a poem by Li Yong Li called Epistle. Before it all gets wiped away, let me say, there is wisdom in the slender hour which arrives between two shadows.
So the first one, well, we all know who he is, but, you know, Stranger in a Strange Land automatically made me think of Robert Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land. And there are similarities. And then the second one, just because I used to love Delmore Schwartz, Li Yong Li, he won the Delmore Schwartz Award. And I always remember that quote, in dreams begin responsibilities. And it just kind of hooked me into everything. But, you know, so I would ask, because I've always thought about that. What is the slender hour? Is it like twilight? Is it like dusk? Is it like the gloaming? Is it like dawn? Is it 3 o'clock in the morning?
Right. I think if you have the whole poem, you get a little bit more context, but the key here, I think, because when you read it, you do feel like it's a little ambiguous. It's this kind of gray area, but he says it's the slender hour which arrives between two shadows. And so what he's talking about, I think, is between dawn and dusk. And so it's, I think he's actually talking about like daytime. There's like this hour where there's this kind of like light, there's something made visible. And I think he's talking about daydreaming as much as he's talking about like the kind of dreams we have at night, which I thought was perfect for the book, because even though so much of the book occurs at night, you know, and it involves a sleepwalking child, like I like to think that all the characters are sort of like, you know, sleepwalking in their own way. They're all sort of in this dreamlike state, regardless of whether it's day or night. I wanted to capture that just like in everyday life. And that Delmo Schwartz story was also at the top of my mind. I actually like looked through that story. Yeah, I was like, maybe there's a good quote there for the, you know, for the front of the book, but I couldn't really find one. But that there is a section in the book that I was really thinking about that story.
That was pretty good on my part then.
Yeah, yeah. It's the first time anyone mentioned it to me.
Well, I tend to forget that there's people listening and watching this, but so we'll get into the actual book. But the thing about it, when you were just saying Annabelle and the daydreaming and nighttime and sleepwalking, it's so funny because in good part, she and Elsie, you wouldn't think, they kind of drive the whole book, don't they?
Yeah, like, at least conflict, the main
thing. Yeah, it revolves around that to a good extent. Okay, before I do that and before I get to, I'll try and stay away from any spoilers I possibly can. If I veer towards there, just like put up a halt sign or something, because I don't want to, because there are spoilers. So anyway, yeah, go ahead and talk a little bit, the spiel that you've learned from all your book touring, virtual book touring, that tells us about the book.
Oh, you want me to talk about the book a little bit?
Yeah, just go ahead and give a summary, yeah, if you want to. Or I can just go ask oddball questions, too.
Well, I thought you did a great job already, but it is a story. It is a book that sort of revels in the quiet moments. And it asks the question, like, you know, what is really happening underneath, right? All with this character, the central family of the Changs, they're new immigrants to a suburb of Dallas, Plano, Texas. And they're all carrying their different fears and longings. But there's this desire to connect, but they don't quite know how to until their youngest child, Annabelle, begins to sleepwalk, leads to a bunch of misunderstandings, which then escalate and sort of force the characters to be less so the kind of model immigrants that they think that they should be, and kind of forces them to confront some issues that have been there all along. And yes, sort of shit hits the fan after that.
Well, it's funny because, you know, at the beginning, like I said, you don't think about, okay, sleepwalking, but you do think about, okay, a kid sleepwalks and the parents tend to sleep with the child or the child tends to sleep with the parents. But then Jack from the very beginning is kind of like a hero. He's there, he's like a sentry. And I wondered about how that came about in your head, that there's going to be this kid kind of he's kind of in loco parentis and is always on guard. I mean, what an enormous responsibility.
Yeah, I think that's the key, is that he carries that responsibility partly because his parents are sort of piling that on to him, but also because he feels like he needs to earn his place in his, not just in this country, but within his own family. Like he was born in China, and then his parents both left for America before he could even remember them. So he grew up with his grandparents while his parents were trying to build a life for him in America. But you know, he didn't really understand that, right? So he When he was six, he ended up rejoining his parents in Texas because he's their son and that's what he should be doing. But to him, he's meeting these strangers for the first time who are his parents. And when he gets there, his mother is about to give birth to his sister. It's like they're already starting a new family, right? So it's really hard for him to find his place. And at the beginning of the book, he thinks one of the ways to like earn his place, at least in my mind, is to be a kind of protector for the family, but especially for Annabelle, his sister.
And it's fun because he never really looks for credit, you know? Like when she's out by the stream and he brings her back, he's not looking for someone to pin a medal on him or anything like that, which is really cool. And the other thing I would ask you, which I normally don't ask you because it's such a cliche, but you kind of are looking for it, is the book autobiographical? And it is, because he's born in the same place and he goes to the same place. And so, you know, you wonder how much more of it is you. I have to ask it.
Well, after that, it gets pretty separate from my life, to be honest. What's interesting is I was also born in Tianjin, like Jack, and I was supposed to do what he did, which was to spend like the first 5 to 10 years of my life in China. My parents were also graduate students, and you know, like they really couldn't afford to have me there, to have a little kid. They didn't have the time either. But what happened was my dad, at least this is how the story goes, is my dad decided last minute that I had to come with them, and whatever burden would be on them, like they would endure it. And that's what happened. Like I went to the States, and I really was a burden. Like my mom had to drop out of her PhD because of me. And there are just things that you wonder as you get older, like what alternative version of yourself would have existed, right? Had I stayed in China, had I, like Jack, re-met my parents later in life. But this is something that so many children of immigrants go through.
Well, it really brings it home to me, because my ex-wife and I adopted two daughters from China. And one was from Qian, where the terracotta soldiers are, and one was from further south. And I always wonder, because you couldn't adopt boys, and then you would see them like sweeping a room that had a dirt floor, and Annie had some challenges, physical, and she would have not. They were both abandoned at one day old at the gates of the city, but. I always wonder, and they wonder too, what would have happened to them. It would have been a complete, but then the culture shock of going to this city in Texas, which is supposed to be a certain way, but it's really a different way. That must have like completely whacked you out to a certain extent, right? I mean, talk about culture shock.
Yeah, well, for me, I ended up moving to Texas when I was one. So.
Oh, okay. All right.
I have no memory, you know.
Oh, I thought you were older.
I know. So, I mean, I was supposed to be like Jack, where I moved to Texas when I was like, you know, 6 or 7. But my memories really started in Texas. But I mean, you're right that Texas itself is like China. It's this like vast, almost like mythic place, right, in the popular imagination. But, you know, it was also my day-to-day life. I lived at times a pretty mundane life. And so like to think about that in the context of all the mythology around Texas and China, it made it an interesting kind of territory to explore in fiction.
One of the things that was really interesting to me was how Patty, her name is in the United States, how she switches so easily from that Silicon Valley kind of parlance back into a completely different mindset, especially, and I guess they weren't Zooming in your book. They were just, it was just a conference call. But I love the way, and you repeat it a couple of times where she goes, and it goes to the other part of the book where she goes, "Thoughts, gentlemen?" And it's like, and it's only gentlemen. It's not any other women. And I thought that was really interesting because she seemed so conversant and so comfortable in that conference call setting where she knew exactly what she was doing.
Yeah.
Versus the idea of driving home, the traffic, reading the email, parking at the old place, sitting there looking at the girl in the window. She becomes a completely different person.
Yeah.
Almost instantaneously.
Yeah, that's a great observation. I think that I'm thinking also like of the way that language operates in different contexts. Like she knows how to talk the kind of English of work, of semiconductors, of technology, of, you know, the business talk. She's very comfortable there. She feels a kind of authority even, right? And then she comes home and there's like just a totally different context of these interpersonal dynamics with kids who have grown up in America, who have learned things in school that she just cannot comprehend. You know, there's a scene, Annabelle like says the word shithead. And she's like, okay, I know what shit means. I know what head means. I've never seen the two together. Like what, like there's so much that's incomprehensible in that world for her. But yeah, it was important to me to like show her authority, at least in the context of work, because while she does at times, you know, obviously make mistakes and do things that maybe are unsympathetic, there is a draw she has to what she does. Like she does love her job, even though it takes her away from her family. There's something meaningful to it. And I wanted to show that as well.
That reminded me when you talked about shithead is you use throughout the book Chinese and Chinese notation and tonal suggestions. What is that? I don't understand what it is, which leads me to the question of why you did it when most readers, if not 90% of them, won't know what it is, other than, which was cool, the contextual part of it. So why did you choose to do that?
Yeah, well, I think now it used to be like a novel thing to do, but I do find in a lot of fiction, contemporary fiction these days, you see, quote unquote foreign language interspersed with English without italics even, right? Like, because it represents the kind of natural mode of the characters. If you're writing in the perspective of characters for whom Chinese is not foreign, it's just like they, you know, when I grew up, we spoke in a kind of Chinglish where, and I still do, where you just kind of mix English with Chinese and it's all just very natural. There's certain words I just gravitate more towards in English, and then there's certain words I gravitate more towards in Chinese. And so I didn't want to call attention to all that, just make it feel natural. And then with the sort of tonal marks, that was something that was a pain to do on Microsoft Word, but.
Yeah, I know.
And then every time I edit, you can't like control F and find it. And so anyway, like I'm really happy my publisher let me do that, because I realized at one point when my early drafts, I didn't have it. But then there's certain words that without the marks, it was hard to like i.e. means like auntie. It's like what you call like your mother's friend or something. But that's just spelled like A-Y-I. And without the tonal marks, it's hard to even comprehend that word, even for me, even though I know the word. I think it just added a level of like nuance. I mean, it's part of pinyin, which is, you know, a way of like putting into, you know, the English alphabet, the Chinese characters. You know, if I could go a step further and just make it Chinese characters, but I didn't do that much. So I did have to sort of, you know, compromise there. But I hopefully it works. It's always languages. There's always limitations in language, and so as writers, you try to find your way around that and to bring out most closely the story you're trying to tell.
Yeah, and in some ways, kind of like the Rosetta Stone, after you see the same word. And that was funny, not to bring it back to me again, but when I was at the orphanage, and all the women, the young women who probably had been there since they were little kids, they were called aunties. All the ones that took care of the little kids were all called aunties, and I didn't get it at first. Mm-hmm. But now I understand it's a completely different meaning from what we would think it is.
Right.
But the other thing is that, you know, Patty's husband, how am I pronouncing it right? Is it Liang? Liang?
Liang, but that's also sort of a complicated question, actually, because there's like an American pronunciation, you know, and then there's like the actual Chinese pronunciation, and then that gets mixed up. But I've been saying Liang.
Okay. Yeah. I'll leave it there. It's so funny because, okay, he's not nearly as conversant in the English language as Patty is. And then the weird thing is he has this poker game. Yeah. And it's just funny that he thought of that. I mean, but the poker game is with Chinese people, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, why? Is that something that's common instead of like, you always read in books, basically, well, it's women. You always read Mahjong, whether it's Amy Tan or whoever.
Well, yeah, it's really, I wouldn't want these characters to represent a kind of what Chinese people in America do or don't do, because it's a giant population and they're always, maybe some are playing Mahjong, some are playing poker, some are, you know, just doing something totally different. But I do, I mean, in the early 2000s, poker was like really hot. I mean, I don't know if you remember, it was like all over ESPN. I remember.
Yeah, it still is.
Yeah, it still is. But back then, I think that's when it really blew up, around that time. So I was thinking about that, how it maybe captured the time a little bit through the poker. And then I was thinking, you know, okay, who are the ones sort of, poker, you know, poker, I think, probably was associated with a kind of white American, you know,
right,
activity, especially, you know, I remember watching ESPN and most people, you know, were white. And I think there is a level of these fathers trying to maybe assimilate through playing poker, but I don't want to diagnose what they're doing. I don't want to overthink it. I think that maybe they just thought it was fun too, but there is probably a level of like, this is what people around me are doing and maybe we should try this out too. And then it gets kind of further muddled when a white family is introduced to to the Changs in the Thanksgiving dinner party, and then later there's talk of, you know, the white father joining their poker game, and Liang is not really happy about that. So there are racial and cultural dynamics at play there, probably, but I wouldn't want to simplify it to only that, I guess.
No, and part of the reason I was asking it is because there are these two congregations in which there's a mixture, but only one couple. And so the Thanksgiving get together, which again is the pivotal part of the book. It's like, okay, you thought, and again, Elsie's parents are the only white couple there.
Yeah.
And things happen. And it's funny because one of the reviews, well, shoot, I don't want to spoil anything. This is a hard one.
We're a little spoiler heavy, I noticed.
Yeah. Who, me?
No, some of the reviews.
Yeah. No, I've been pretty good, right?
Oh, you've been great. No, I meant like, there's a couple of reviews I read. I was like, oh, that kind of gave away a big thing.
I know. I was always amazed, like M. Night Shyamalan's The Sixth Sense, that no one gave it away. I mean, yeah. I was amazed that it was like the whole world didn't give it away, because if they did, it would never have been the movie that it was.
Right, right.
It was just like some kind of secret league that they weren't going to do it. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
So at that party, I'll approach it a different way. When you first introduce Elsie through Annabelle, you think one thing about her. And I was thinking, oh, that's really mean and unfair. And then something happens and you realize it's not what you thought it would be. And it changes your whole viewpoint of Annabelle. Mm-hmm. And that was like a really interesting thing that you did. Again, without spoiling it.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how to talk around it. But it's a sort of maybe Shirley Jackson move, right? Where
that's what I thought.
Where like characters, yeah, it is maybe a in the sort of gothic tradition or something, but at the same time, it's very realistic to me. Like everyone inhabits certain contradictions, and depending on who we are around, what context we're in, we're different people, just like what we were talking about with Patty. Same applies to Annabelle. She's one person at school and around her friends there. She's one person at home around her family. Especially around her family, she is like, she really plays up her childishness and dependency, you know, on her family. But she's also pretty smart. And she has a sense of how to get people to do the things that she wants. And so that sort of manifests through the novel as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because this sleeping with each other thing, it's kind of a codependency. It is a codependency. And it also seems definitely seems weird, mm-hmm. to this reader. You know, it really seems weird. Okay, why don't they just, you know, they could. But then when she comes home really late, it's like she's forcing the issue. She didn't have to go check on the kids, you know, and he wants to do it. And oh, that reminds me too. So sex, being an old white man, I'm thinking of the way that Patty, first of all, approached Leon. And then also there was an implication that she did that earlier with someone else, kind of stayed over kind of thing. But and at least to me, I thought there was a second possible liaison. Maybe no.
Okay. I'm trying to think.
It was just one sentence. It was just one sentence, which is good because other, you know, if I have this in book club, they're going to say, no, she did that too. But yeah, there was one sentence where she met a guy and it was like, I won't say anything else. You can
look. Would it be a spoiler to tell me what that sentence is? I can't remember.
But it was just like, okay, well, what was she more? Okay, so just go back to the way she approached him, because he was not nearly as she was, even for months or years after. So is there that type of Chinese woman in China at that time?
Yeah, I'm sure there was. I think that, yeah, I don't think that she can represent like a kind of Chinese woman or a trend. I do think that she did differentiate herself from a lot of the women around her, because she was rather vocal and direct, and you had to be, I think, to be working in the sciences, and as she was surrounded by men, right? And you had to present a certain version of yourself to sort of be respected and taken seriously, and to the point that Liang sort of began to, because of his background, I think too, began to sort of be her, to really take her lead, you know, follow her lead, I mean, for pretty much everything, even following her in a way to America. And the same thing does happen in that later sex scene in America that takes place in, I think, chapter 2. And so she's, yeah, I mean, I think that she's really interesting because in America, she does also have to present the suburban housewife, to quote, I think that term unfortunately came back to prominence with Trump's tweets, but like, which, you know, obviously is so antiquated, but.
Don't start me on Trump, by the way. Don't start. If you start me, that's the end of the interview. You'll never have another word, okay? So just stop.
I was trying to avoid saying Trump in all my interviews. This might be the first time I said the word Trump. But yeah, I mean, she's having to grapple with so many different narratives that are just projected on her. The suburban housewife, the submissive Asian woman, you know, there's so many other stereotypes, I think, that exist. I mean, you're either submissive as an Asian woman, or you're a kind of threat, or, you know, or you're kind of like hyper-sexualized or something like that, right? And I think I just wanted her to be free to be who she wanted. And sometimes she dips her toes into those stereotypes a little bit, but she also inhabits other versions of herself.
Yeah, because they're very well drawn, not necessarily completely happy. And then once in a while, one specific instance, she does something that's kind of not conventional in terms of a sexual act. And you drew that. I mean, it was really interesting the way you drew that, because it wasn't like, it was like, it was bad, it was good, it was wrong, it was right. It wasn't pleasant, but I don't know. It was really interesting. That whole night was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think it just, there ought to be more like characters like her that should be given the freedom to, you know, number one, just to like depict like Chinese immigrant parents like having sex, like that itself for some reason seem to have the agency in fiction or in movies and stuff to do that. So I thought it was important to write that scene for one reason, but then to even go a little bit more deeper and like to think about like the ways in which this is late at night, like we have like these weird impulses come out, and there's also this fraught kind of tension between the two characters, and they haven't had sex for a year, right? And like sex has always been this fraught thing between the two of them. I mean, obviously writing about sex is very hard, and this might have been one of the hardest scenes to write.
Yeah.
Because you always fear that you don't get it right or something like that. But it was freeing to when I came to the realization that it's not, there is no way to get it right or wrong. It's not there are obviously clear boundaries in sex and consent, but I'm not writing like a manual of like what's right or wrong. I'm writing about two specific characters, and sometimes like sex is a really messy thing. And so I kind of tried to lean into that.
It's interesting too, because that made me think, you know, I'm acting like there's four characters, and there's not. There's this whole backstory that's on a different continent. And then you realize that what you were trying to do, at least what I think you're trying to do, is this is partially, well, mainly a lot of why they are the way they are now. And each of them have, you know, between parents and or absence of or grandparents, or your mother being on the moon. Did that backstory come first and then you moved on, or how did that work in your head?
I think it started, it was sort of a little bit of both. It wasn't the very first things that like came in the drafting, but I think I had a sense of who they were in the present. And then you kind of poke at the character a bit more. You ask questions like, why are they that way? And you do draw from the past. But then as you draw from the past and as you deepen their past, their present selves also can kind of change on the page. You know, as you get to learn about your characters more, the people they are, that also changed. So it was a little bit of just this gradual, it's just kind of how I write. I didn't have these characters fully developed in my mind. I learned about them as I wrote these drafts.
It's funny because, and we'll talk about it again, because we talked about it before in the interview, about the book being quiet. And it's funny because thinking about it, the only real like kind of like jaggedy kind of communication was when Jack's grandparents kept ripping on him all the time, you know, saying what a lousy guy he was. And then that phone call where they're the only ones that really like yell and scream that way. Mm. Right. I mean, it's really the only dialogue that's kind of like really nasty. I mean, Patty and Liang, yes, but it's really funny how they treated Jack and just acted like he was a complete jackass. No pun intended.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, it's interesting because I think Jack, for most of the book and like most of his upbringing with his parents, he might have, they so assumed and took for granted his obedience and his independence that they didn't like feel the need to like lecture him or to punish him or to tell him what to do the way they did for Annabelle. To the point that I think Jack almost craved it. Like he wanted to be yelled at a little bit because it's a form of attention and he wanted attention. And I think what's more hurtful is this feeling of apathy that I don't think his parents are apathetic about him, but he probably perceived it that way at some point.
Yeah, plus he's like the second and Annabelle takes precedence just because of the way they feel about her. Not necessarily the way she is at the time, because they mold her in part into what she becomes. But, and that's true about Jack up to a point, one point, at the Thanksgiving party when he's upstairs with his dad, he does dissemble. You know, there's one spot where he dissembles.
Yeah.
And that's the only time he abandons the hero image, which is interesting.
And there are a lot of different motivations and like allegiances pulling at him because he's also trying to protect his sister, himself. And he's a child, so he kind of overthinks it, I think. And he doesn't really know the consequences that lie in store. It kind of dawns on him later, but once he makes the decision that he makes, it's, you know, he has to sort of deal with that.
Yeah, if we were kind of doing a Venn diagram or drawing circles and we were talking about what congregations like the Thanksgiving and the poker, the other one that's really interesting, and there's peripheral stuff to it, is Elsie and Annabelle on the jungle gym, on the monkey bars.
Yeah.
And that's like an event all into itself. And who would think, you know?
Well, I think, yeah, that's, in my memory, that's where all the drama was during Easter. Right.
I mean, you learn a lot in about three pages, and it's in a strange place, and it's between two kids. Mm-hmm. And you realize this is the way life is. This is the way people treat each other. Look, and I'm not going to mention the T word again, but that's exactly how those interactions become true or untrue or fake. Yeah, so you're right. Kind of drove a lot of it. Oh, so okay. So as we're getting near the end, I guess we talked in the beginning about the quietness of the book and, you know, all the reviews talk about how quiet it is and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, so this idea that I suggested about negative space, why don't you go over again, because this is in a different context. Why don't you go over again, you know, because that's, you know, everybody is, you know, they're talking about this being like a specific person's movie as opposed to another person's movie because of the quietness, the darkness, the subtleness. So you obviously chose at the very beginning that this was going to be the kind of book it would be. So why did you choose to go this quiet way that some people might think, oh, nothing's happening? And then a lot of stuff is happening.
Yeah, it's this, I think it's what I'm drawn to often in fiction. And I know that's maybe not for everyone, but I think fiction for me is most powerful when it's, what it can do uniquely well is bring out consciousness and interiority. And like you can have a character step into a room, like in an Edward P. Jones story, and they're not just stepping into the room, they're stepping into the room that it used to be and the room that it will be, and they're carrying their histories and their their longings and their hopes and fears into that simple act of walking into a room, right? Like, fiction can do that in a way that I really don't, it's really hard to bring that out in other in forms of storytelling. And so that's what I'm drawn to. And but then for this book specifically, it felt right for the characters because they, you know, I love to see reckless and loud, you know, Asian American characters in fiction because that's very cathartic. And when they do that, that's also, I mean, for a particular story, it makes a lot of sense. But like for these characters, it wouldn't work for them. Like they don't know how to be loud, or they don't know that they can be. I didn't want to make them super self-aware, right? And to be a kind of like anti-stereotype, you know? I didn't want to make them stereotypes either, but I didn't want them to be like so actively countering the stereotypes. Like I wanted them to just be real. And so they buy into the system sometimes because they have to. But in spending time in that quiet domestic space, my hope is that like I bring out aspects of them that then we would skip over in other stories, right? Like to make those quiet moments somehow thrilling at the same time.
Yeah, it's like the total antithesis to Crazy Rich Asians.
yeah. And I love that like Asian American storytelling can have Crazy Rich Asians, but I hope that it can also have space for this kind of story, right?
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing about it is those kinds of, they're great. I don't really want to interview them, but they're great. But it's like there's two kinds of books, and this is, again, book club stuff. But, you know, some people like to have the books end so that it's wrapped up, you know? You get ready to go to UPS, you put it in the box, you put the shipping tape on it, and you address it, and then it goes. And then other books, it's like, there is no box. You know, there's no box at all. It's just like all this stuff is just thrown on the table. And the reader's like, what am I supposed to do now? And those are my favorite kind of books. It's like, so you're pretty much leaving it up to me, I think, right?
And that's what I love to experience as a reader. Like I love that feeling of like being able to create alongside the writer. Like they give me a lot of the sort of pool of like imagination to draw from, but like every reader is going to have a different relationship to a book. And I think a book lingers when a reader is allowed to sort of, you know, to keep thinking about it and to imagine beyond the ending. Whereas if you tie it in a bow, it's like you're telling the reader, like, this is how you're supposed to, you know, take away the ending and perhaps the book itself. It's just more directive. And I don't personally like to do that as a writer.
Yeah, and this is not a spoiler. It's just like, okay, the last three words of the book, it's like, okay. Okay, what are they gonna do now?
Yeah.
After the door opens, yeah, it's like, shit.
Your reaction right there is like my ideal, like that's just what I wanted. Yeah. So I'm glad to see that.
So that's what I've been actually thinking about it. I wonder, okay. Maybe they'll just, you know, maybe it'll, and I was thinking, no, I don't think it will. But you know what I mean? It's like, I don't know. But that, you're right, that is great. I'm not saying great like you need a sequel to it. I'm just saying, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I'll think about this for a while. All right, that's a good place to end, except I will find that one sentence.
Okay.
I'm going to find that, and then I'll send it on Skype or I'll text it to you. And then you can tell me whether I'm right or wrong.
Okay, yeah, I'm very curious.
That's what I was looking down at. I was listening to you, but I was looking down here trying to scroll through and find it so I could surprise you with it, but I couldn't find it. I was doing keywords in a search, but I couldn't remember the guy's name. Maybe there is no name. I'll find it though.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Simon. This was great. It was a great book. I loved it. Well,
thank you. Yeah. Thank you for taking the time. Hope the bookstore is doing all right.
It is surprisingly. Oh, that's good. Yeah. We're open. 4 days a week. I had no idea that we could drop ship books to people, and this bookshop.org thing is doing great. And, you know, I don't like to look at it as charity, but, you know, this idea of supporting local businesses has really worked well. So I'm happy. I'm very happy.
Oh, that's great.
Okay.
Thanks again.
All right. Yep. Bye.